thank you, Jim. It's definitely a pleasure to be here. I trust everybody can still hear me in the back. We have a goal to only one person fell asleep. We can't put three asleep here. So if we don't accomplish anything else, we've got to make sure we don't exceed one. I appreciate your remarks, Paul. We'll try to follow suit. As usual, these slides will be available on our Ag Manager website. I'll show you at the end. I tell you that all the time because you're welcome to write down numbers, but you're going to have access to them later. So if I go a little fast on a few of these slides, it's not because I'm trying to hide something from you. I'm actually very transparent. You'll see everything later. But I'm more interested in getting the key story across and an opportunity to hand the mic over to Ted here in a minute, so I'll respect our time. Most of you know I like to start with this one simple slide because I will probably put more than one of you to sleep. But any well-trained economist thinks they can explain many things in the world by talking about supply and demand. I'm no different. I think you can understand a lot of what's going on prices and margins throughout the entire cattle industry if you pause and recognize supply fundamentals and fundamentals. On the supply side, we still have what I would call a tight supply situation by long-term standards, but it's not as tight as it was a couple years ago. We pulled the trigger on herd expansion. I'm going to give you specifics on that in a moment, but I think we're going to look back on the last couple of years as being the low in terms of number of animals in the industry for a while. So the tight supply part of what's been going on, we continue to ease, and I think we're going to keep doing that as we expand the industry. It's important to recognize, though, the tight supply was one of the key reasons you had very high cattle prices, okay, looking back. Flip over to demand. Demand's less understood, and this actually some of this fits in with some of Paul's remarks, than on the supply side. It's very easy to look at USDA production numbers to understand what supply is. It's a little trickier to understand what demand fundamentals are. Simply looking at prices is sufficient to understand demand, for example. But nonetheless, demand has been very strong for U.S. beef. Actually, I would suggest the last 5 years we've had year-over-year growth in beef demand here domestically. If you have strong beef demand coupled with tight supplies, both of them are pulling prices up. So it doesn't matter if it's our calves, yearlings, fed, wholesale beef, anywhere in the chain, prices have been higher the last few years, both because of tight supply and strong demand. Sounds a lot like what I said last year, right? The core of that hasn't changed. The part that has changed is we pulled the trigger on expansion, so we're going to start easing that tight supply story, and there's some growing concerns about just how strong that demand is. So the nuances of that story that we're debating now, but the core at the end of the day, trying to understand prices, is pretty much the same as what I was saying right here. Okay? I like to share this slide. Some of this information is from a group called LMIC, Livestock Marketing Information Center, that's based out in Denver. I know you can't read the numbers in the back, but you can see them later. What this is quarterly information. The first along the top is 2015, so to give you some historical context of where we just were. The middle is projections for 2016, and then the bottom is quarterly looking out to 2017. I really want to call your attention to the purple arrows. The purple arrows are up for 2016 and 2017, because this is the production slide. So the first thing you'll see is commercial slaughter. In the middle is average dress weights. On the far right is commercial beef production. All of those are projected to go up in 2016 and 2017. I'm not going to break it down by quarter because I don't think we should do that in this setting. You can read that later. But that just reflects we pulled the trigger on herd expansion, larger calf crop, ongoing trend of a little higher dress weights gives us more beef production. That's the synthesis from that slide. Okay? Flip this over to the price side of things. This is organized the same way, that instead of production, now we're looking at prices. We have the five market fed cattle price first, followed by 7 to 8 weights, and then followed by calves on the far right. These arrows, of course, go the opposite direction. Right? 2016, 2017 are projected for prices to come down from the levels we had the year before. And that shouldn't surprise you. We've already experienced some of this, but the projections going forward are for that to continue. To give you specific numbers, let's look out, let's see if I can laser work. The third quarter of 2016, LMIC is projecting basically $2 calves for the third quarter, under $2 for the fourth quarter. Okay? These projections were last updated on February 12th. Since then, the board's actually up a little bit, so you could add to that if you wanted to have a current forecast. But the real point is, those dollars, around $2 forecast, are quite a lot lower than we had in the third quarter of last year. They're in line with what was experienced in the fourth quarter of 2015, which of course was the large drop in prices that occurred between Labor Day of 2015 and when most calves sold in 2015. Okay? I don't want to dissect every one of these numbers, but I'll remind you the general direction of these arrows going down is consistent with what the futures market is expecting. That's basically easing the tight supply story and a fairly stagnant demand environment. So if you don't have an increasing demand and you add more supply, prices have to go down to clear the market. That's what's on this market. Now let's walk through cow-calf stock and feedlot kind of margin by margin for a moment. This is a chart that goes back to 1987, again from LMIC, where they're trying to give us a barometer of profitability for a representative cow-calf operation. I believe it's a 400-head operation in Oklahoma is what they're synthesizing here. It goes back to 1987, includes 2015, and has a projection for 2016. I made this statement last year, and it still holds true. A few years ago, this is easier to show the scale, the number, the dollar per head was much lower. The 2015, 2014 margins were historically high. The 2014 margin is this really big bar that broke $500. And we can now look back and already say, 2014 was great, we wish we had another year, right? That was in the past. I would encourage you to maintain context on just how good that was, not in just recent history, but long-term history. The purple bar here is at about $150. We used to call that good years. We blew that out of the water in 2014. And in 2015, we actually had a really good year like this. Fast forward to 2016, LMIC is still projecting a good year, but obviously not nearly as good as we had in 2014. The number behind that 2016 projection is $200 return. So that's a $200 return over cash cost. On quick cowboy math, $2 calf price is $1,100 calf value. If you're running for $850, $900 cash cost per cow, that's your $200 margin. So real crudely, that's what's behind that projection. Okay? What I want you to take from this is, I suggest that is still sufficiently positive to keep the expansion ongoing. Now going further, I think if it rains, I'm incredibly confident we're going to keep expanding. Now, that doesn't mean I'll be right. I'm just telling you pretty confident what's going to go on. Okay? And part of the reason I'm so confident is we're already doing it, and I think it's going to continue. This chart right here goes back to 1986. Again, it's more USDA information that LMIC pulls together, and it shows us how many heifers are being retained. 2016, we most recently got this in the January cattle inventory report. There was a 3.3% increase in heifer retention compared to the year before. And I want to call your attention to the fact that 2015 bar was also a huge jump compared to 2014. So it's the second year in a row we've had a big jump in the number of heifers we've retained. Okay? We've pulled the trigger on expansion. This chart tells you the same information in a little bit deeper way. The past chart was total number of heifers, but it made no consideration for how large the breeding herd was. Everybody in this room knows we started, say, 2014 with fewer mama cows in the industry than we had in the past. If you look at this relative to the size of the breeding herd that we're retaining females from, that's what this chart is. So what I've plotted is heifer retention as a percent of the number of beef cows to give you a sense of the relative effort to expand this industry. Going back to 1970, this is this U.S. heifer retention number, the average was we retained 17% of our females as heifers and plowback into the industry. That's the average over this whole time. What I want you to recognize is we've been over 20% over the last 2 years. It's an incredibly strong signal that we're trying to expand. I'll circle back. Positive margins, evidence we're already doing it. If it rains, I think we're going to keep expanding heifer retention and therefore calf growth over the next few years. Okay. Where we're at in this cattle cycle, this is a chart that shows us cattle cycles over time. Most cattle cycles from when we initiate expansion to when we hit the peak to when we stop declining and start all over again go 8 to 12 years. That's the historical pattern. I don't know if that's going to be the case going forward or not. There's a lot of things different than it was in the 60s, but nonetheless, there is a biological pattern, as Paul noted, that's part of what's going on here. To the extent that holds going forward, we are very early in this cattle cycle. Typically, it takes 3 to 5 years to hit the peak, and then we start declining. You can see that across these other cycles. I think we'll hit the peak in 2 to 4 years. I don't think we're anywhere near it because there's still a margin to be had, and in the past, when we stopped having a margin, we still expand for 2 more years because it's A, it's hard to hit the brakes. And secondly, some people look backwards at profits a year ago instead of forward for a year, so maybe they expand even more than they should in hindsight. Combine all that, I think we have a few more years of expansion ahead of us. Okay. That's all the remarks I'm going to give you, purposely very, you know, 30,000 foot level for cow-calf sector. Transition over to the stocker segment for a moment. Most of you know I like to call attention to this website resource called beefbasis.com. The value of it is it gives you insight on value gain. So stocker business is just a margin business. You need to know your value gain relative to your cost of gain. Those of you in the room are stockers know that better than I do. This resource gives you insight on the value gain side of that. I just included two examples just to motivate and try to get you to use it. The first one was, as of this morning, looking at the Salina market, what if I currently have a 700-pound animal and I'm entertaining whether to dump it next week or put another 50 pounds on it? Now you can change this story, just give you some insight into the current situation. Well, if I'm going to put 50 pounds on over the next month, That would be basically a 1.7 hour daily gain. The value gain associated with that, it's implied from the futures market, and basically the basis forecast that are underneath this, is $87 per hundredweight. So in this story, if you could put those pounds on for less than $87, and you're comfortable with the risk associated with going on for another month, there's a positive margin to be had. If you can't do it for 87, or if you're uncomfortable with the risk of being exposed for another month, then it would make sense to sell next week in that example. You can do the exact same thing looking out to this fall. So look out to September, so the upcoming wean crop, right? You could purchase somebody's 550 pound calf and try to put 200 pounds on over 3 months, or you could stretch this over six and have a lower average daily gain. You can do this on your own. But what I want to give you some insight here is, if you put a lot of pounds on early here in Q4, the market's not encouraging you to do it right now. All right, so building plans is not encouraging because the value gain for that is about $62. The main reason for that is if you compare the feeder cattle contract for the end of the year, there's a steep decline. If you delay that purchase 1 or 2 months, so you can't read this at the bottom, but you will increase that value gain. It'll go from $62 to $75 or from $62 to $91 per hundredweight if you can delay and do the same thing by just waiting another month or 2 months to purchase it. I'm giving this as an example. Do your homework before you purchase something if you're a stocker operator, because the market opportunities vary a lot, and they're probably going to vary even more going forward as these price weight scales change compared to what they've been the last few years. We just had a tight supply story. Okay. That's all I'm going to say on the stocker side. Round this out, get to feedlots. Obviously, we're setting Kansas. Feedlots are a big deal as well. Most of you might know, myself and Kevin Newbetter, who's no longer in the department, revamped an effort to take the focus on feedlot information that comes actually from this department. That gives us a lot of feedlot production insights, so average daily gain, and weights, out weights, that kind of stuff. Couple it with market price information and put out what I call a barometer of profitability for feedlot industry. Now, it's important, and I know I sound like a lawyer when I say it, but I'm not going to apologize for it. It's important to appreciate that this is a no price risk management store. So I'm paying cash for feeders, I'm paying cash for corn, I'm taking cash for feds. That's what I'm mimicking. So it's a real kind of clean and artificially simple margin indicator. Lots of feedlots mitigate some of that risk, right? So probably this overstates how good sometimes are and how bad sometimes are. This is the point of that. But nonetheless, if you are a farmer feeder not doing some of that, or anybody that's not implementing those risk management strategies, I think this can mimic, okay? So with that as background, you can see lots of variability in returns. Go back to January 2002. The last 2 years have been two totally different stories. 2014 is this chunk of green bars. Returns, we estimate for that cash to cash to cash kind of story, were very good in 2014, and the best month ever was $320, I believe, in July of 2014 closeouts. That was because if you bought feeders and were exposed to the market, didn't hedge, you were rewarded because live cattle prices went up in 2014. That was what was underneath that, okay? Fast forward to 2015, we have this whole chunk of red, huge losses that we're talking about. The opposite happened. If you bought feeders, paid cash for corn as you went, and were exposed to fed cattle and didn't protect yourself, you were penalized for being exposed to the market. So if you did the exact same thing you did in 14, you made a lot of money trying to do that, in 15, you gave it back, you did the exact same thing, right? Very different story, and the main reason for that was the price decline that happened, largely in the fourth quarter of 2015. The blue line right here separates what, quote unquote, has happened, our estimations of what's happened, versus what we're projecting to look forward. And you can see we're projecting ongoing losses, but for placements today, they would be out here in this arena, you know, 6 months out, we're basically projecting break evens. So if I can distill this down for the feedlot margins, the market's closer to, quote unquote, equilibrium of getting placement prices in line with expected corn prices, in line with expected fed cattle prices to be break even, which is much closer to a lot of these outcomes in the past that have been exaggerated in the past. Whether or not that's going to happen this summer, I don't know, right? You could have a huge change in live cattle price between now and then. But looking at the board for live cattle prices as of now, suggesting placements today are going to be much closer to break even than these large losses we've had the last 6 months. Okay? I have a chart in here about demand. I made a comment real early. 5 years in a row of annual demand growth. That's very important to appreciate. And I wanted to distill down an important point, because it's pretty rare I get something that's clean to illustrate. For 2015, the year as a whole, per capita beef consumption was up slightly. So that's a green, it was a small increase. And the main reason that was up was we actually exported less than we thought we would. Some of those pounds stayed at home. The net of all that on what was available to consume was a little bit up. Not a lot, but a slight increase. The inflation-adjusted all-fresh beef price was up over 7%. 7.7% is the number we can't read. Anytime you can get any industry to consume more of your product and pay more price for it, that only happens if they value that product more than we thought. Something was done right to get them willing to open up their wallet to pay more and consume more. Normally what you think is, if I'm going to make you take more of something, I got to drop the price to clear the market. You following me? It's a pretty basic point. In 2015, we had a really good, nice outcome. More products sold, albeit a small amount, nonetheless, more at a higher price. That is quote-unquote proof in e-com world of demand growth. Okay? In the past, we've had declines in the amount consumed, mainly because we have declines in what's produced, but the price increase was so high that it's still called a demand growth. In other words, that price increase was larger than I expected, so there's still evidence that the public was willing to pay more than we thought. Those are really good things, and going forward, the industry has to maintain that, if not expand that, demand strength to absorb what I'm pretty sure are more beef pounds coming. And I'm also confident it's not just beef coming. So we're sitting here giving a beef talk. I only have one slide that's non-beef. This is red meat and poultry. The beef industry's in the midst of expansion. The pork industry, the broiler industry have already pulled the trigger and they're gonna keep doing it. This is quarterly projections of red meat and poultry production. The brown bar is 2017, the kind of turquoise is 2016, the darker blue is 2015. The story is for all four quarters, 2016, 2017, more meat, more meat, more meat. That strong demand story the beef industry has been able to have so far, the last 5 years, must maintain to mitigate some of what is downward price pressure that would come otherwise. And I want to make this last point as it relates to exports. My last slide earlier was about domestic demand strength. It's going to be very important as we expand meat production in general, and beef in particular here in the U.S., that we succeed in getting more pounds out of the U.S. I'm not against consuming beef in the U.S. as a point of clarification. But the opportunities, there's a lot of people in income group outside the U.S. that hopefully will value our products more than forcing people like me to eat one more pound than I plan to eat. I'll gladly eat three ribeyes in 1 week, but I might not pay the same price for that third one as I did the first and second. As an example, Paul was giving that point earlier, I'll phrase it differently, right? There's only so much room for some of these additional pounds before domestic consumers will beat up the price to consume more. At some point that becomes a concern. The optimistic view would be we get more of those pounds outside the U.S., right? That could be a win-win. I'm including this slide to give you some context that to date the beef industry has been, I'm going to call it marginally successful on that front. This is percent of production that's exported over time. It goes back to 1992. I put a red line here, not because I think there's a real ceiling, but there's a ceiling we have yet to break. And on an annual basis, we have yet to export more than 11% of what we produce. The U.S. beef industry largely is reliant on the domestic consumption front. You can look at that as a blessing because we are a fairly rich country that likes to consume hamburgers and so forth, so it's been good. But I also think it might handicap the industry a little bit going forward if you accept the notion that income and population growth is going to be pretty strong outside in certain countries. So the point of this, without giving a full international trade talk, U.S. beef industry, I think, has to make it a priority to break that 11% number because we're going to continue to produce more. And if we don't accomplish that, there's a lot of barriers to it, I'm well aware. We're going to have lower and lower prices at home because you're making people here consume more than they otherwise plan on. Okay? To wrap this up, and I'll hand this over to Ted, to synthesize it, cow-calf sector, I think 2016 still looks, by historic standards, like a really good year. To the point I'm pretty sure we're going to expand if we keep training. But it's not going to be as good as 2014. So, you know, look at 2014 as God's gift to you, if you like, but don't plan on it happening again. That's what I would encourage you to look at that as. 2016 for the stocker segment, the margins vary a lot depending on when you look. So I was trying to give you that illustration for the upcoming fall run. Just going 1 month later to a placement changed by $10 in value gain, and it may not have any impact on your cost of gain. So exactly when we're looking is very sensitive to the price weight slide, like it used to be. I think that story might develop more here in 2016. Look out the feedlots, given our projections of what the board looks like, hopefully the worst is behind us from these returns. We estimate actually a minus $500 loss in December closeout, which is astronomical. I hope that's behind us. The market suggests it probably is, but that doesn't mean it's going to be the best year ever. So hopefully we're going to kind of eat our way out of some of these bad losses, but probably not some of the extreme positive. With that, I'll hand this over to Ted.
Thank you, Jim. I'm not
going to
review what Jim said. But Glenn thinks he's done, but he's really not. I didn't even warn him about this. But for one thing, he's the middle of the semester, right? I'm a teacher. And right now, I'm programmed to go for 2 hours. So once I get to the podium, or the microphone or screen. The only thing I can give a piece of chalk would go for probably 2 hours. And if I start doing that, I might ask them over to tackle me because we got to be out here for that. So I'm giving him one assignment. The other one is, those of you who see me present things over time, you know I sometimes get a little passionate about these things, right? I really get into this stuff I do. And I was actually on my laptop working last night, and the debate happened to be on in the background. And I heard the comment, actually, it was Ted saying it, but this time it's going to have to be Glenn saying it. I get carried away, Glenn. You got to say, Ted, breathe. Okay. So although I'm getting a little too carried away.
They're just going to leave on us.
So two assignments to keep me in line. And somebody has to. I'm going to get down to the question a little bit, and I'm going to do it fairly quickly. It's a topic that we could really spend a lot more time on than I'm going to get into tonight. And talk about price discovery. Anytime we go through the kind of market velocity that we've seen in the last year, and the kind of price movement that we've seen in the last year, we've never seen quite that magnitude of $30 moves, but on a percentage basis, value of the product, we've seen similar kinds of velocity moves, percentage basis. Anytime we go through those, we are back in a discussion again. How do we discover the price on transactions day to day and week to week that will accurately reflect what's happening in that wild market? And here we are again. And this time, because prices were in such a downward spiral, we're grumbling in a bad mood about price discovery in the industry, and I think there's some reasons why we should have some of that concern. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, give you some things to at least ponder and think about as we're looking at price discovery in today's market environment. And there are aspects of today's market environment that make it different than the price discovery discussion we would have had even 5 years ago. And I think, again, it's things we want to think about that might change the way we do business transactions on a day-to-day basis. This graphic is a 6-7 year trend pattern in how we are establishing price for value to Fed capital in the US. The top green vibrating line is formula pricing, negotiated that orange line. And then you've got four contract position grid down there on the bottom. What I want to point out, first of all, is just go back a few years, back to 2010, and we had about half of our industry formula pricing on about the other half that was negotiated. And most of those formula trades were being based off of the negotiated trade. About half and half, and then you had some other stuff going on in the contract. Go forward in time, and what we saw was a rapid escalation in formula trade and a rapid decline being displaced in the negotiated market. So increasingly more of the formula data being priced off of fewer of the negotiated trade that's occurring. Now, about a year ago, or a little less than that, when I looked at this pattern, probably a half even, and I looked at the downward spiral of the negotiated trade, I started to think, man, is this cattle industry heading the way the hog industry has already gotten? Those of you who may follow the hog industry at least casually may know already that they're down to around 3% of the day-to-day trade being negotiated and 50 or so percent of the rest of the market forming the pricing off that, and then a whole bunch of contracts in the rest of the market. And it looked like we were heading there. It looked like we were going towards a very rapid mirror of what they had already witnessed and realized. We slowed down, and we actually increased back up a little bit our negotiation. Now, what's kind of interesting here is you look at the forward contracting. Basically, what happened when we had high cattle prices, the 160s, about a year ago, there's a lot of forward contract activity going on. It makes sense at a high price to take advantage of it. As prices decline, we shifted some of that forward contract back over to negotiated. And that's been the displacement lately. If you look and take it, let me just This is looking at just the last 14 months or so. So just boiling down the last year of that graph. And what I just want to show here is we're much more stable. That long-term decline that we've seen has sort of stabilized this year. Core contracts representing up there around 50-55%. Negotiated has bounced around between 20-25%. Core contract moved around a little bit. But things aren't spiraling down like they were. If I'm in a formula market, that's comforting for me. If I'm in a negotiated market, it's also comforting because both benefit from having some volume. If I'm negotiating, the reason I benefit from having volume is because one of my most important sources of information for my next negotiation is what the last negotiated price was. And if the last negotiated was hours ago or somewhere else in the country, it's much less informative than if it was minutes ago at my name. All right, so it benefits both sides to have some volume in any kind of market or having information flow that's reliable. We stabilize. So it does suggest that there's some more stability occurring at least now than in the cash market and how we're negotiating versus formula pricing. Why don't you look here for a second at Kansas? Because Kansas follows basically the same national trend. There's a lot of noise in this thing because week to week we have variability that occurs in this industry. But if you look back to 2010, we had a typical week in Kansas. We had about 35,000 head of cattle being negotiated on the cash market with Fed cattle trade. You go down, there was actually September, I think, that bull point there, that one down in there. It was only about 300 head traded one week in September 2014 in the state of Kansas. Well, that's no trade. That means one or two pens negotiated that week. Where do you get your market information when that's occurring? You go somewhere else. Well, I'm going to show you that going somewhere else is a little bit challenging because of what happens in our markets on a regional basis. We have rebounded some from that. And this last, especially 2 or 3 months, has been pretty interesting to see that we are renegotiating. Now, we're still pretty low. This is still, you know, at 25,000, we're still probably about 20% on a week-to-week basis, give and take. It's varying, right? That's about 20% of our total Fed cattle marketing total state right now being negotiated. I don't want to make too much of this to say that we're out of this 5,000 head a week thing and now we're at a new level of 25. I think that just a small number of players can make that change pretty quickly. And it could certainly be a nuance of moving away from forward contracting over to cash negotiated pricing. So I'm not saying we're doing a new plateau and the industry no longer has to worry about price discovery. My point is that we do have more information now than we had 3 months ago in that negotiated market. It's flowing more liquidity and more fluid price information. If those who are negotiating decide they don't want to again for a while, and they leave that market, we can go very quickly back down. And that at that point becomes a little more problematic with price information. This is a mess, but I want to show you the big factor. What this is in the 5 major markets the mandatory price reporting covers, the percent of negotiated cattle in each of the major regions that are being represented. And there's a couple of points I want to make here. So if I actually don't even have Texas, or I don't even have Colorado on this graph, it's so small, it's irrelevant. It just makes more noise than an already very noisy graph. So I just drop that. So it's the top 4 here. Red one there, Nebraska. So you can see Nebraska has gone from where they were representing on a weekly basis about 35% of the total negotiated trade going on around the country. It's occurring up there. And you can see Kansas was similar. Kansas was about 30% back in 2010. Iowa and Texas down there around 15. Well, what happened as Nebraska continued to negotiate and Kansas quit negotiating or slowed down their negotiating, Nebraska started representing more of a proportion of the total trade in the industry on a week-to-week basis occurring there. Not here, not in Texas. Notice Texas went from 15 to nothing. There is no price discovery occurring in Texas. There hasn't been for a couple of years. And Nebraska became more important. And likewise, Iowa, which is 15, became 35, and sometimes even up over 50 or close to 50, 45% of the trade that week, representing our market being in Iowa. Now, I'm not discriminating because I don't care whether it's in Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, but the point that's very important to recognize is these are separated and segregated markets. We have a national Fed cattle market, and they're all somehow related to each other, but you know what? Regionally, the prices vary and diverge. And they vary and diverge for very important reasons. It's because of local demand and supply conditions that differ across the regions. And because cattle are so expensive to transport very far, you get divergence among these markets. Now, why? Let me illustrate that a little bit and just show you. I'm going to take the Kansas price minus the price that we see in Iowa and minus the price we see in Nebraska on a weekly basis for the last year. What I want to show you that's important to recognize is that these markets move broadly together. And if I put up a graph over 10 years, they look like the lines lie on top of one another. But when I start digging down week to week, Kansas price, for example, is at times has been as much as $6, more than $6 higher than the price being discovered in Iowa. Kansas has recently been between $2 and $3 more than the price being discovered in Nebraska when we do have a discovered price. If I'm in Kansas and negotiating on an anchoring, or if I'm forming the pricing, Nebraska, or Iowa, or if I'm in Texas doing that, recognize I'm forming the pricing of a market with different localized demand, supply and demand fundamentals. And so what becomes really important here is as we look and say, what is our market going to be relative to somebody else? It's not the same. And we are at times discounted relative to those markets, and we are at other times in a situation where the value of our cattle is worth more.
Ted, let me make a quick point. So most of the room heard the stories about 1,700 to 2,000 pound animals right at the end of 2015. Most of those stories were associated with eastern Nebraska and Iowa. So look up here on what Ted has for roughly the September through November period, actually October through December on this chart, the Kansas-Iowa jump, right? Part of an example, one a recent example of Ted's point on supply and demand varying locally, heavyweights existed in Iowa more than they did here in Kansas. And it showed up in that price spread because the market was more depressed in Iowa, those heavyweights. That make sense? You want a recent example of Ted's point, it goes on all the time.
Recognize too, this has implications both again, closer to negotiating, because obviously you got to be careful if you're negotiating where you're anchoring your latest information off of. If you're looking at the five market average, be careful. Because at times it's being swung by somebody who's in a different setting than you are. Remember, Iowa at times has over 40% of volume represented in this market. Likewise, it's formula price. We have heard a lot of folks say, well, if I formula price and my local market is too thin, I'm in Texas, why don't I just go to the five market average? Or I'm in Southwest Kansas, why don't I go to the five market average? You can recognize what you're doing. You're going to be pricing off of some other local supply and demand condition drivers that may not always be in your favor. All right. A couple more. I want to shift over to futures and talk about it for a minute, and then I'm going to shut it down so we can ask questions. The cash market and the futures market for live cattle are obviously very intimately linked. What happens in cash influences futures. What happens in futures influences cash. Not only just from a day-to-day, week-to-week price discovery perspective, but from structural issues that are happening in those markets. Make no mistake about it, some of the challenges going on in futures right now are directly related to some of the issues happening in the cash market. So I want to just make a few comments and point out some things there and see what's happening in the futures market. First of all, what's very apparent to anyone who watches that market, just like the cash, we are in a more volatile market scenario now than we have seen historically in this industry. This is simply the typical range within the day in the live cattle futures contract. Notice we used to be the typical day, having about a dollar movement from high to low. We're now typically a $2 movement from high to low, and we've seen much greater than that in the last few months. What's that mean? Well, think about this for a second. We do a lot of stuff. Quinn mentioned CattleBasis.com. We do a lot of stuff with basis. Anybody who hedges, you recognize you've got to watch basis. You have to be able to anticipate it if your hedging program is going to work for you. And hedging doesn't only mean, you know, where is it going to be that month that I lift the hedge relative to what I expect it to be. That's part of it. It also means now, what hour of the day do I place the hedge and lift it? Because we're having typical day range that's exceeding 30 bucks a head value on the futures exchange alone. So the timing of the decision is very important. And if you go and procure your feeder cattle with a projected budget on the other side that has a hedging program with it, and you prefer the cattle at 9 o'clock this morning and wait until noon when you get home to place the hedge, you could be at a $1.52 on a typical day move. You could be larger. The break even can suddenly become something not nearly as interesting and fun to be involved with. So, point is, we are at elevated levels of variability, and one has to recognize that environment. Now, something I'm going to just throw up here to let you digest a little bit. One of the things that people say is, well, if we're at elevated market levels and the market's crazy and we're getting these limit kind of moves happening, should we do more to try to reduce volatility? Should we institutionalize ways into that market so we slow it down a little bit? And I'm gonna challenge that a little bit just for a couple minutes here and say, I'd be cautious about doing that. And here's why. This is just simply what our daily limit that the futures market right now allows, live cattle futures and CME, the price to move by before you would have a lock limit and shutdown trade. It's been $3.50 for a long time, and here's the percentage of the market that limit move represents. So typically, it used to be the limit move is about 3 or 4% of market value. Today, it's 2, and it's been 2 for 3 years. Think about that. What that does if I'm a trader, whether I'm a hedger as a cattle feeder, or whether I'm a hedger as a beef packer, hedger as a food processor or a food manufacturer, or even a speculator providing liquidity. If I recognize today that we're in a highly volatile market, remember I just showed that, we're at elevated risk. Our risk is maybe twice what it was 5 years ago. Oh, and I'm also in a market that's scrunch. If I want to get my trades made, I have the risk being locked out of this thing in a hurry because we've got a tight limit relative to the value of the commodity and this price is moving around on me. Tight limits, folks, can actually make me anxious and make me push the button harder, faster, and bigger. Because I know I need to get that trade made today. Tight limits can actually exacerbate volatility within the day. Now, I haven't tested this empirically, but I can see this being part of what could be happening. Look at limits in the cattle market compared to our other ag commodities. This is the daily limit right now for corn, soybeans, wheat, soybean meal, and live cattle. We have a much greater limit as a percentage of the underlying commodities price in the grains by far than we have in the livestock commodities. Limits will become much more difficult to operate around when they're that tight. Let me make my final comments here and then we'll open for questions. What are we doing already? Well, we tried to do some things about futures to make it more viable, to make it more linked to the cash, whatever's going on in the cash. And linking sometimes that thing is difficult because so much happening in the cash market too. What do? We change trading hours. All right, why do we do that? Well, we felt like there was maybe too much happening outside of a core window of trading that was too low of volume. So let's try to contain time over which people do make money. He talked about an 8-to-5 or something. I think we're now at an 8-to-3, the 105 or in that market. Why we closed live cattle before corn closed, I'm not sure. I think you would have wanted to go the other way. But anyway, regardless, we did that. Shorten the time period. We've added messaging restrictions. What's that? Well, that's for algorithmic traders. Traders that are trading without actually doing anything other than let the computer make the trade. We said now you actually have to, you're going to be monitored in the live cattle market for the volume of messaging is simply the number of times that something comes from your system in to signal a buy or sell. And we're saying we're limiting that. Again, maybe that could influence volatility. That's very new to the livestock agreements. Been in grains for a while, but it hasn't been in livestock. Why do I have to deliver? We're doing some other contract thing. What else are we looking at? Well, I just mentioned the trading limit thing. I think it should be on our radar. We should at least think about it. Expanding trading limits doesn't necessarily mean the market's more volatile. Now, some of these in the what might be on the horizon actually look contradictory to each other somewhat. We'll see here in a minute. A delivery directive, for instance, we're looking at actually maybe the Worthing market might deserve a delivery discount. Now, remember I said Iowa market at times is discounted relative to Kansas by a sizable amount. We'll talk more about that, but getting attention to differentials in the delivery. Batch trades, that's an interesting one. Batch trade idea is that we'll let a whole bunch of trades come into the exchange, we'll hold them for a bit, and then we'll have the whole group that came in all go out to the matching algorithm together. Rather than letting them flow, the idea is here, I don't want somebody else who's closer to the market and has better technology to beat my trade in. All right, so this is a very down in the weeds timing thing. Batch trading, I don't know. Would it help? I don't know what it does. Nobody really does know what that thing might mean for volatility or the implications of liquidity in this market. Holding trades for a second. There's another interesting one that's on our table. The idea of holding trades is that the main momentum here was that, well, if somebody puts in a large trade, they should not be able to pull it back out quicker than a second of when it was submitted. That's what the mindset around that one is. And algorithmic trading does that. Algorithmic trading can make 10 trades, 15 trades in and out in a second or less. Right? It's like nanosecond. So I don't know. I don't know. We're tweaking here at the edges and we don't really know what the impacts of these are going to be because we haven't really studied or even been able to test these kinds of ideas. Instituting trading halts, in other words, circuit breakers. I'm going to think about those. Let me just stop the last one. And this goes over to the cash part. If negotiated trade continues to be the less favored, it's a small portion. The idea with the electronic market that's being introduced is to find a more palatable and easier, less disruptive way for the producer to market the cattle on electronic exchange. That's the idea behind that. I just talked to the guys involved yesterday. They're going to launch this thing real time with actual cattle yet in March is the plan. So you're going to see it here pretty soon. I don't know where it goes. It's a much different looking institution than we've seen in our industry here for a while. On the live cattle side, I think it could have an interesting implication because I think it does make it easier for the guy that's forming the trading to put a few cattle over there to negotiate it without giving up the things that they benefited from. I've talked too long. Questions.